Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will speak about intelligence. I am, on purpose, omitting the adjective artificial, because we will engage in a process to reframe the hyped debate on that topic. For this conversation, I'm happy to welcome James Bridle to The Sound of Economics. James is an artist and technologist and author of the fascinating book Ways of Beings, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for Planetary Intelligence. James, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me. I'm good, thank you.
Ways of Being has been my favorite book. I've read it during the summer, and it's actually one of my favorite books in a couple of years' time, together with The Dawn of Everything by David Graeber and David Rengrow. So I would say, James, you are in good company in my list. The second reason why I'm happy you accepted to record this is that I will soon leave Bruegel, and this is among the last episodes of the podcast series that I host. And I've been admiring your work for a long time, and I'm simply happy to be able to share this with our listeners. But let's go into the core of our topic. In your latest book, you argue that intelligence is relational and ecological. And thereby you attempt to somewhat release the elusive concept from its anthropocentric cage. To do so, you draw on a quite impressive array of science and art, and to which you are entitled by background. You have built self-driving cars, databases, websites, windmills, and robots while writing and giving lectures. So a common question pervades your creations. What are the effects of new technologies on our society, economics, politics, and everyday life? And what is our relationship to the other beings we share the planet with? So maybe I will start with this very broader question related to your practice to hook in our conversation.
The way that I always examine new technologies and pretty much everything I come across is for the assumption that they're, you know, fundamentally not separate from the rest of life. Over the last kind of, you know, almost 100 years now, digital technologies become a huge, huge part of everyday life. And they affect it in all kinds of ways. They affect, you know, just the way we do our jobs, or the way we meet our friends, the way we communicate with each other. But they also affect the way we think. The metaphors of technology, the metaphors of computers, the way that computers process information becomes kind of the way that we process information as well. And the way we put these technologies to work, but also the kind of mental models we have of them. And some of us, you know, have almost no mental models of them at all. They affect the way that we act in the world, or the way that we can act in the world. So, you know, so much of my work is about kind of diving into technologies, picking them apart to understand, you know, first and foremost for myself, how they work, then to compare that to how, like, mostly they're understood to work. You know, what's the gap there between, like, how people understand them working and what they're actually doing? What's the hype around them? You know, all these kind of questions. And then also to think about, you know, how they could be perhaps constructed differently. Both how we could literally build them differently, but how just by even thinking about them in a slightly different way, we could change the way that they act in the world.
So this brings me to the question of intelligence and artificial intelligence. AI is appearing as both a technology, a cultural idea of what intelligence is or might be, and it's kind of squeezed in between the techno-dystopian accounts of the imminent end of the humans as we know it, and this techno-utopian bonanza kind of images forecasted by the others. And you have been trying to reframe this and getting to the roots of the meaning of intelligence, right?
Yeah, so I was so frustrated by the same thing. I mean, I studied academically AI 20 years ago, when it was sort of both in a very different place, and actually not a very different place at all, in the sense that the kind of the ideas underlying, let's call it computational intelligence, smart things done by machines, hasn't really changed that much in those last 20 years. And in fact, it hasn't changed that much since the 60s. The main ideas that underlie current computational intelligence were formulated back in the 1960s under the name of things like connectionism and the development of neural networks. There were some other ideas along the way. Most of those didn't really work out, things like expert systems and other ideas of what computational intelligence might be. Eventually, we basically developed enough computational power and gathered enough data to make this quite old neural network idea work. But as I say, it's whenever we hear all this hype about AI, it's worth remembering that this is really not a new discovery. It's not a new idea. The thing that's really changed to make it possible is the last 20 years of the internet, which has created a series of companies that have A, made huge amounts of money, and so can afford huge numbers of computers, have built huge numbers of computers in order to support their operations. And they've spent that 20 years harvesting huge amounts of data from the public internet, from social media, from the systems that they run, and so on and so forth. And those are the two things that build, that kind of underlie most current AI. Very powerful computers, huge amounts of data. That's kind of interesting. It's also, you know, only one, it's just really fast, powerful computers. So the first thing to say is that AI really is not some magic conscious being thing, right? It's just very fast computers. And that's very interesting. But it's still also interesting to me that at the same time, AI has this extraordinary cultural weight, that we're completely obsessed with it as a culture. You know, and there's this, as you said, this kind of complete kind of mishmash between the reality of fast, powerful computers and science fiction ideas of kind of giant robots taking over the planet. And it's still really hard so often to kind of disentangle those things. What I'm really interested in, actually, is how those science fiction ideas influence the development of the actual technology, how they're used as part of the kind of hype around it to make AI seem like so many things before it, somehow inevitable in the kind of corporate capitalist form that it takes, that we, the tech companies, are inventing this science fiction thing, and that's what makes it sort of true and right and powerful and inevitable, crucially. And also why that kind of shapes our understanding more broadly of what intelligence itself is. Just as I said, that, you know, 80 to 100 years of digital computing has shaped our idea of what kind of information processing and acting on the world actually looks like. So this idea of AI is shaping very strongly our idea of what intelligence is at an incredibly crucial moment for rethinking that. Because, you know, this is colliding with a moment of deep ecological crisis, which is itself the result of a kind of human individualism and human supremacism, this idea that we are kind of separate from the world. And a big part of that is our idea that our intelligence is sort of unique and special, which feeds into our relationship to AI in all kinds of ways, but also, you know, makes us ignore the incredible breadth of intelligent behavior in all its forms that exists on the rest of the planet at large.
We are going to go in a second into this last part, because that's really the core of some of the ideas in Ways of Beings. But let me ask you to step in for a little while more into hyped AI and the fact that the computers we have now are basically, as you say, old new machines to a certain extent. Because what seems to me, and what also you write in the book, is that most of these computers are basically very specific kind of computers. We're thinking about computers nowadays as those are the computers, but basically they are specific kind of computers which are binary machines. And somehow, for people who are not really into the history of computer science or cybernetics, they might not really grasp that very important element, that these are only actually one kind of computers which we are building. And from this, I think that a lot of the other reflections about intelligence might spur in our conversation. But basically, in your book, you tell us that the world is a computer, and that there are so many other possible ways to build machines, computers, and so forth. What exactly do you mean there?
To be clear, I don't say that the world is a computer. I say the opposite. I say the world is definitely not a computer. That computers, we Right. quite often mistake computers for the world because they've become such a powerful way for us to to interact with it. Almost all of our interactions with the world, you know, because most of us live these days kind of in cities, in incredibly human constructed environments, most of our ways of interacting with the world and even with you know, one another, with other humans, are mediated through computers. And so they're assembled from this sort of set of technological metaphors. You know, I keep coming back to this, you know, example of, you know, how we interact with our friends, you know, through messaging systems, through social media. Now, that has a certain form, and that form is a set of metaphors for how people communicate. Things like forums, things like instant messengers, things like kind of your news feed or Twitter feed, or so on and so forth. Those are computational models of human communication, and they come out of certain ideas of how humans communicate. I think, you know, Facebook is a classic example of this, where the you know, one guy essentially at you know, college in the US decided to attempt to model the way mostly white, mostly male college students interacted, and then basically rolled that out as the social system for the entire planet. You know, the computational model enables that to happen. It's very powerful. Everyone kind of subscribes to it in some way, but you see it break down in all of these kind of really terrifying ways that we're seeing today. What I'm interested in particular is the thing that I always come back to is this question of technological determinism. Because technology tends to get rolled out in this kind of huge global way because of the internet by people who claim to have this kind of special knowledge of how it works, it often feels kind of inevitable. And it feels like we have no control over how it works, that we shouldn't be able to decide how that works. And so in my work, I spend quite a lot of time going kind of back to bits of computational history, moments in the past in which kind of decisions were made about this, choices were made. And, you know, one of the very interesting moments in that happens right at the dawn of computation, when Alan Turing kind of specifies what he called the universal machine, the automatic machine, what we call the Turing machine, which is the very first kind of binary computational machine that forms the basis of all computers we use today, right? With a few exceptions, these new crazy devices like quantum computers and stuff like this, but pretty much any computer any of us touch or that affects our lives, computers inside planes, computers inside ATMs, computers inside cash machines, your phone, your laptop, all of these things, they're Turing machines. And the thing about the Turing machine is it is only one type of computer. When he was first developing it, one of the things that Turing writes about is he writes about this problem that the automatic machine, the Turing machine, has, which is that it can only do whatever you tell it to do. It can only do things as a result of its programming. And this is still true of all computers today, including all of the fancy AI stuff. Yes, they're learning, you know, new behaviors, but those new behaviors are only the result of the parameters that have been put into that machine by the people who designed them. They're not, doesn't mean they're foreseeable. It doesn't mean they're not very powerful, but they have to be pre-programmed in this way. And in one of his very first papers, Turing writes about another type of machine that he calls the Oracle machine. And this is an entirely theoretical machine. That he says that, you know, it must be possible, or at least it must be kind of thinkable, to imagine the kind of machine that doesn't only do what you pre-program it to do, what you tell it to do, right? It must be a computer that's capable of learning from the environment around it, that can take information out from the outside once that program has started. And then he kind of leaves it there. He just goes off and makes the automatic machine, and we get the entire digital world that we have today. But what he's describing, really, when he's talking about the Oracle machine, is he's talking about something resembling actual life. He's talking about something that later became cybernetics, which is a whole field of study that asks these very weird questions about what would happen if computers were more like living things, essentially. And they also asked what if living things were more like computers, which has slightly more creepy answers. But they're always interested in this this idea of if essentially, what if these things were more connected to the world? What if technology wasn't a thing that continually abstracted from the world, that turned it into a model that separated us from the world, but something that actually made us grow closer to it, made us more aware of it and more connected to it?
So basically, to correct my sentence before, you basically don't tell us that the word is a computer, but you are telling us that the computer is part of the word. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then basically, one of the... if we start to think like this, everything changed, because if we cannot think about computers and humans and the world, so animal, plants, as separated entities, artificial intelligence might not be, after all, so artificial. And this has some sort of implications, correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, after thinking these thoughts and bringing lots of examples from the non-human world, I also struggle to think of that, you know, if something is truly artificially intelligent, then it's not artificial at all. Intelligence is not something that just exists within the head. It's not something that even exists just within the body, though. It's I consider it as something that's embodied. It relates to your context, right? There could be no such thing as the intelligence of a brain in a jar, because it can have no relations with the world that allow it to do that intelligence. I talked about cybernetics earlier, and one of the big kind of watchwords of cybernetics was that intelligence is a verb, right? Intelligence is an active process. It's something that's done. It's not a fixed quantity, which is also, incidentally, why things like IQ tests are rubbish. Intelligence is something that is done in the world, that is a response to kind of context and relationships. So if you or I have an interaction with an intelligent computer system, that intelligence is something that's sort of passing between us, right? It's something that's emerging out of that interaction. So there can be nothing artificial about that. But it also goes kind of much deeper than that, in the sense that there's nothing, you know, for me, artificial about computers at all. Artificial is one of these terms that humans use to kind of keep ourselves safe from the rest of the world, to not be kind of sullied by the kind of dirt of the world itself. Which is the result of a long, centuries-long process of kind of alienation from the world that is part of the damage that we do to it. You know, we build computers out of the earth. They're made of metals and plastics, metals that, you know, including very rare, strange ones that we dig out of the side of mountains, plastics that we refine from the bodies of like million-years-old sea creatures. They're, you know, animated with these kind of electrical sparks, you know, from burning or from the wind or from the sun. You know, they're deeply elemental kind of portals into the world, just as kind of everything else is. And it's only the kind of illusion of human specialness and separation that allows us to kind of call some things natural and some things artificial, and to keep ourselves at some kind of remove from all of that.
Well, and in order to make us understand the fact that we are not that separated from the rest of the world, and why we should rethink all this, you delve into evolution, and you basically go back to evolution theory, and you try to bring in another element which is complementary to the well-known adaptation kind of system, which is randomness. And you couple randomness, adaptation, with these relational elements of being related to each other and change through the relations of different beings or different species of different elements even. So to me, this was quite an interesting part of your reflection, because it linked our own breadth of evolution, but also to things which are quite of immediate application, you know, like bringing in the randomness element within the equation of the different things we are doing, of how we build the machine, how machines operate, but also how do we operate and our relations with the world, seem to me quite interesting. But maybe you can explain me a little bit more why this is so important. And especially, for instance, if we look into economy and democracy, why this is actually quite groundbreaking to a certain extent.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the examples of the kind of power of randomness that I give in the book, that relates little to this kind of cybernetic idea of being connected to the world, is I look at the kind of machines that we have developed that are a bit more like Turing's Oracle machines. So one of the, there's this really interesting thing about computers, these kind of Turing machines, is that they can't generate randomness. They can't be random, because in order to do anything, they have to be pre-programmed, as we said. And if you pre-program something, then it by definition can't be random. There must be some kind of underlying pattern to it. But randomness is also something that we need. We need random numbers inside our computers to do things like cryptography, for example, or to run lotteries. And we come up with all of these extraordinary ways of doing that. In fact, most lotteries still, for example, use loads of bouncing balls because it's more random than a mathematical process inside a computer. In Britain, for a long time, they used these computers that would take the temperatures of like fluctuating gas within a tube that might be disturbed by kind of radio waves or by even like particles coming from space. There's a cryptography company in the US that uses cameras pointed at lava lamps. This kind of connecting computers in this way to the world in order to generate randomness, which I find to be kind of fascinating and beautiful and demonstrates this kind of possibility of randomness. And once you start getting into why randomness is so important and generative, you kind of find it everywhere. The obvious example of that, of course, is selection within evolution, which operates at the deepest level as an incredibly random process. It's a kind of legacy of Darwinism that we tend to think of evolution wholly in terms of kind of environmental pressure, competition for resources, competition between different species, that's a product of environmental pressures. But beneath that, there's a huge amount of random selection going on. In fact, it's randomness that drives the possibility of that selection, because it's randomness, the way in which genes recombine, the way some are damaged, change, mutate, which are not environmental pressures. They're the things that actually create the difference that then the competition at the higher level acts upon. So randomness is the kind of driver, essentially, of all forms of life on Earth. And it's a thing that we can harness in all these interesting ways. We can harness it to change the way we do computation, an example of these kind of random machines. There's a long, very long history of artists and creators of all kinds harnessing randomness in this way in order to produce kind of novelty and strangeness in their works, but also to produce a relationship to the world. You know, instead of these kind of rarefied types of music, which are incredibly, you know, composed out of the purity of the human mind, someone like John Cage looked to random processes in order to create a music that he felt was less, you know, solely human and belonged to the world in some kind of way. And I'm particularly interested in current forms of kind of organizational democracy that are picking up on these kind of creative possibilities of randomness. And I spent a lot of time with things like the Citizens Assembly in Ireland, which was based on a democratic model that says, well, what would happen when faced with really complicated societal problems? What would happen if instead of selecting a very narrow group of people that we think are experts in this subject, self-proclaimed or accredited or whatever, and instead of having a narrow group of people who already know a lot about this subject, or at least know a certain amount about the subject, what about essentially if we took a bunch of people at random? Which sounds crazy. It sounds like a denial of experts, but it's not a denial of experts. What it is instead is saying that actually what you need is as broad a range as possibilities of perspectives on any form of problem. And what they did in Ireland was they took 100 people from across the electoral roll, and they put them in a hotel for a bunch of weekends. And they were given information by experts in certain subject areas about certain problems, certain issues that the government in particular was struggling to address. But then they debated amongst themselves. These people selected, as I say, completely at random. They had the discussion. And the results of that were an extraordinary set of political decisions, policies, proposals that went not only... There were two amazing things happened out of that. The first of which was they managed to reach a consensus around really complex topics, the most famous of which is the decision to overturn the ban on abortion in Ireland. That was a question that was so contentious in Irish life that politicians wouldn't even touch it. But because the assembly was able to reach consensus around the need for a referendum, that referendum happened, and there was this huge epochal shift in Irish politics around abortion policy. So first of all, consensus is possible, which sounds completely crazy, not just because we're talking about 100 random people from all walks of life, but also because we know that consensus is like one of the biggest problems of contemporary life, that we live in this kind of incredibly polarized society at present. Yeah, so that's interesting. And the second thing was that a lot of the proposals they put forward were really quite radical. they were addressing environmental policy, for example. They put forward a bunch of policies, which the government subsequently adopted, that politicians had thought were too radical for ordinary people to accept. Right? So you get consensus and you get this kind of incredible radicality. And that's a result of this broad range of experiences coming to bear upon a thing. Because, you know, when we're facing new, unprecedented, complex problems, the answer is not always to reach for solutions and strategies from the past, from our existing knowledge. We need to come up with new ways of thinking about the world. And those will emerge from multiple ways of thinking about the world.
Sorry to interrupt, but basically what you're saying is we need to go beyond the computational binary logic and embrace the Oracle machine to a certain extent.
Yes, that's one way of looking at it, but I think the more powerful one is just to understand that every intelligence acting, like the computational intelligence is one kind of thinking, right? And any individual person's kind of thinking is one kind of thinking. And when you have many people in a room, you have many different ways of thinking to be done. There's no like singular one way of thinking, right? And so it's very, what you do have, of course, as we know from groups of all kinds, you have groupthink, right? And when you have a lot of people who work in the same subject area, they quite often end up thinking quite the same. So the systems assembly idea that I was talking about was the way of breaking that, right? You bring these like quite radically different ways of thinking together, and you bring them all to bear in a problem, and that totally changes the nature of this kind of collective thinking that becomes possible. The argument that I make in the book, of course, is that if you buy that, which I do, there's lots of evidence for it, and there's these systems assemblies popping up all over the place, and they're fascinating, and I really recommend people look into it and check them out. If you buy that this idea of like the way to address like some of the most complex, difficult problems we face is to bring all these multiple ways of thinking together, to approach them together, and to put them into dialogue with one another. And you think of intelligence as something more than human, as something that is done by people and by machines and by non-humans, animals, plants, microorganisms of all kinds, then you have to think about the thinking that we need to do as a society, as a species, as a planet, as a collective operation as well. That we need to bring in those ways of thinking from beyond the human to work together as well, to acknowledge the intelligence of other beings, listen to them speaking to us, and put some of that knowledge to work.
That would have been my next point, which is how you expand your reflection, and also with practical implications, from this concept of having different ways of thinking within a human assembly, you know, an assembly made by human, to expand this concept to something that is encompassing machines and other species and so forth. You make some examples as well about how this kind of solidarity between the human and the non-human, I mean, what we call the modern human, could actually happen in reality and could constitute a new political agenda.
Yeah, so to the kind of thing that I mean about this kind of sharing of knowledges and this cooperation, I'll give a couple of examples. We already use. You know, there's problems when we talk about using other creatures in this way. We do use creatures in all kinds of ways because we understand that they have certain knowledges or behaviors that we need. One of my favorite examples is in a lot of the larger water pumping plants in Poland. They have muscles inside the pumping plants that are connected to little sensors, because muscles are incredibly sensitive to impurities in water, right? And so what they do is that before the drinking water goes out to everyone's taps, it flows through these beds of mussels. And if there's any impurities in the water, the mussels will almost instantly close their shells. And the sensors detect this and they'll shut off the water immediately, so this contaminated water, drinking water, doesn't go into people's taps. And the mussels are there helping us, using this knowledge, this skill they have to protect us. And we should thank them for that. So we already do this sort of in certain ways, understanding that this knowledge and behavior exists. And I'm talking about broadening this quite extensively. Another favorite example of mine is some experiments, well, ongoing system that's being built in Italy to do advanced earthquake detection. And what happened here is that some scientists who specialized in tracking animals, they put sensors on a range of different animals, on goats, cows, dogs, sheep, in a few locations, in a village called L'Aquila in central Italy that's prone to earthquakes, and also on the slopes of Mount Etna in Sicily, thank you. And they recorded the like levels of activity of these various animals. And if they've been doing that for a while, there were earthquakes in these places, and they could look at the data and they could correlate the movement of the animals with these earthquakes. And they basically found that they could predict earthquakes in advance, further ahead than any other system we've ever developed. Right. And again, this is like fascinating in several ways. Firstly, because like this ability of animals to detect earthquakes has been kind of mythologized for a very long time. It's a kind of folk knowledge, but there was no scientific framing for it because we don't understand how they do it. Like, we've no idea why animals have this sense, because like seismographs don't show anything, humans don't feel anything, but we can see that animals behave differently. And then when we lay this kind of technological sensor network over them, we can see at scale. That's one of the really good things that technology can do. It can kind of increase the scale of our vision in this way. So we can see this animal behavior happening in real time and act on it. Another super interesting part of that is that that data is not immediately visible. Like, you can't look at the data coming off these sensors and be like, oh, there's an earthquake happening. It's not visible to humans in that way. They had to process that data. In order to do so, they used a bunch of machine learning algorithms, right? They were originally developed for trading on the financial system, which I find to be incredibly beautiful, because I'm not a huge fan of the use of high-frequency trading or whatever, these kind of trading strategies to generate money out of the system. But I do love the idea that those same systems could be turned in a completely different direction to mediate between us and non-human animals, and produce this kind of knowledge that's incredibly beneficial to us. So you've created this kind of incredible system where we are listening to the animals essentially through the mediation of these algorithms. And again, quickly, without having to fully understand what's going on there, I think there's something very significant in the fact that this is not a scientific experimental situation in which we have uncovered some mechanism that the animals are using, and then we're going to kind of reproduce it or pen it or whatever. No, like, we just have to live with and listen to the animals carefully to understand what they're trying to tell us about this situation. And that, for me, is a fundamental change in our relationship as well, where it acknowledges this knowledge that they have, this ability to share it, and that we start to pay attention to them perhaps in a slightly different way.
This is very fascinating, and I would say, going towards thinking about the future, if there is one way that you describe with your examples where those other species, with the mediation of the machine, so this kind of interspecies machine and humans cooperation, is working at the benefit on the benefit of the humans, after all. And I think that there is also something to say about the other way around, like, you should give it back. Like, if this is like the building of a solidarity between species, what is your vision of the future about how this solidarity could work also on the other way around?
Fundamentally, it has to change. As I said, it has to change our relationship to non-human species. The relationship that we've had. And again, this is a good point to stress that when I keep saying very lazily we, I largely mean European, North American, Western, science-centered thinking about the world, which is not global. Much of the world thinks differently, and the reasons we think that the way that we do are is tied up with governmental scientific history, with histories of imperialism, colonialism, that have been disseminated around the world, much like our technologies. And there's plenty of non-Western indigenous knowledges and cultures that speak to this very clearly, which is simply that we have to respect the creatures that we share this planet with utterly and totally, to give them the same respect that we would give one another. We know this from our own survival. We know that the way in which we treat the planet is not only damaging the fabric of the world around us, it's damaging us. We know that burning fossil fuels is both poisoning the atmosphere, that's causing global raising temperatures, that's killing creatures in the sea, that's killing off all kinds of plant species. It's also directly killing us. I mean, I'm sure you might have seen the data that's come through in the last few days of like air pollution in Europe, that 95% of people in Europe are living with particulate levels in the air around them that are dangerous to human health. Like, we are killing ourselves through our behavior. And that extends, right through to our treatment of non-humans, through systems of factory farming, through clearance of the land for grazing, through our consumption of meat. All of these questions. All of these are questions of what is our relationship to all the other inhabitants of this planet? How do we value our lives and the lives of everything else that lives around us? Because the destruction of any of those lives always and comes back to the disruption of our own life and life ways. We need fundamental changes to the way that we relate to the rest of the world. And a very, very, very good place to start with that is changing our relationship to non-human species.
I think this is like a very powerful message. And I would say we quite dissected the book. And I really would like to invite all our listeners to have a look at it. But before, also because we don't have so much time left, but before we leave, I have one last question, which is rather methodological. Our listeners are mainly interested in economic policy. They are in economic faculties, or they are within the large constellations of actors which are contributing to policymaking directly or indirectly. With your book, you're definitely conveying also a methodological message that art and artists have something unique to bring in conversations which usually, even in the academia, are very compartmentalized. How do you see the contribution of art and of artistic practices such as yours, of course, and why should we build more bridges between artists, economists, and political scientists?
I mean, I think I've probably answered that question already to some extent when I've talked about this necessity of having multiple different ways of thinking to approach a problem. Art really is mostly just the place in which, you know, ideas end up when they don't fit into any other kind of useful or well-defined category. But it is the place in which, you know, a lot of other ideas kind of get warped, bent out of shape, rethought, reconsidered, and kind of, you know, switched up from the ground. And that's clearly deeply, wildly necessary in the present moment. In my work, I read scientific papers, I look at the latest scientific research, but I also look at works of kind of ecological philosophy, or, you know, as I mentioned, I look to the work of artists like John Cage. You know, I write about Dali in the book as someone who was also like interested in how you think about non-human relations and time in all of these ways. Any one of these things can be things that kind of spark a novel way of appreciating an idea that was previously seen to be self-evident. All I'm really ever interested in doing is pointing out that most of our thinking is based on a bunch of assumptions that we never ever question and barely even see as being assumptions at all. But there's always some kind of, you know, weird bit of undermining or rethinking or re-wondering to be done about those things. And for me, that's, you know, that's why I do some of these things within the realm of art. I do some of them within the realms of writing. All of them are processes for me of that rethinking, of trying to puzzle something out at length, try and think about why I think about it the way that I do, and the most interesting being, can I think about it differently?
Thanks a lot, James. And unfortunately, we could discuss for much longer, but this is all the time we have for this episode. And I would like to remind our listeners that, as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. James, thanks a lot again for joining this conversation.
Thanks very much for having me. Been a pleasure.
And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.